Well, we're going to be continuing our way through the book of Job, and if you have a Bible, I'll invite you to take it out. At this time, turn with me there to chapter 8, which we'll go to here in a few moments. Growing up, we had a really good family physician. The only problem was this guy really lacked sort of a bedside manner about him. And a story that we all remember is when my brother was still really young, he went to go get him a checkup of some sort. So he had to sit on the table, and the doc said, "Open your mouth and say, ah." So he opened his mouth, and the doc put that tongue depressor in there, and he gagged, you know, right there. And it's like, "Open your mouth and say, ah." So he opened his mouth again, stuck that tongue depressor in, gagged him once again. Did it a third time, "Open your mouth and say, ah." So he opened his mouth, and when he gagged, the doc went, "Ugh." And really intimidating for a kid who's only about 7 years of age. It's like, "Open your mouth and say, ah." And my brother was kind of looking at the whole thing, thinking, okay, listen, even as a young child, he knew, your chiding me doesn't really help in this, all right? I'm gagging because you got a tongue depressor in my throat, and that's what's causing the problem. And all your fussing about it isn't going to contribute to helping the situation one bit. Well, in many ways, that's going to be like the individual that we're going to look at here today. I mean, be honest. How many of you, whenever you're going through a difficult time or you're going through something really tough and you're hurting or you're sick, and you got that person who comes along and they're trying to travel the road of compassion, but they somehow get lost in the woods of obtuseness. And then they begin to just say and remedy and fix things for you right there. It's like, "Oh, you've got that medical problem. You know, I had this, doctor. Let me tell you what you need to do." You know, and they're just going to solve all your problems. And you look at it and you say, "Thanks. You have no idea what I'm going through." But they're quick to give the advice. Well, if that happened to you, you might have met Job's second friend, a fellow by the name of Bildad. Maybe some of you, you poured your heart out to somebody about something, and they listen, and they go, yes. Have you ever read the book of Leviticus? Because it addresses your problem specifically. And you hear that, and you think, yes, I've read Leviticus, and no, this isn't helping me one bit, not at all. And right now, some of you are thinking, you know what? I might have actually been the one who was a Bildad to somebody else. Quick to offer the advice and the counsel and to tell them how to fix their problems. Well, as we look at Job's three friends and their counsel, we have a difficulty as we do so. Because sometimes some of the things that their friends say is really good doctrine. Some of the things that they say is true. And one of the difficulties we have is how do we parse out the things that they're saying that is true and valid and some of the things that aren't true and valid. Now, last week, I introduced this to you here just for a little bit. Let's see if I can get it called up. Here we go. We call it the stage of truth. And I've got it listed there. You've got the front of the stage. And this is how you will determine what truth is. You begin with God's word, scripture. What has God said on the matter? That is truth. That you can take to the bank. But is everything that we have, every question that we have directly answered in scripture? Not always. And so sometimes there are things, some doctrines that are a little bit harder to understand. So what we've got to do is we've got to move a little bit further back on the stage to color in the lines. And that's why you've got on the next line, I've got church tradition. And by that, what we mean is really 2,000 years of spirit-filled believers and where they've commented and said things. We have things like the creeds that help us. We have documents that the church has relied on and gone back to sort of get an understanding of what has God said. But you're also called to bring your brain to the door. But notice where reason is. It's not at the front of the stage. Because sometimes there'll be things Scripture brings up, and your reason goes, "I can't make sense out of that." And the call is, your reason has to take a back seat until it can get caught up. Maybe in this life, maybe not until the next life. But reason has a place. Then you have other things that help you in truth. You've got the creation. And as you look out and see what God has created and how God has created, you learn things about God. You don't learn everything about him. You know, you will never understand the plan of salvation merely by looking at creation. But it serves its purpose. And then you've got things like your experiences. Boy, is experience a good teacher? Yes, it is. But sometimes even experience cannot necessarily point you in the right direction in terms of truth. And same thing with how you feel. You may see an act of injustice and you may feel that's not just. And you may go, that's a right feeling. But it may not necessarily, it can't be necessarily on the front of the stage of truth. Your feelings have to take a back seat as well. Well, last week we looked at a fellow, his name was Eliphaz. Remember, we called him Mr. Logic. And he's going to be some sort of computer software engineer, and he is totally into algorithms. And this is how he sort of understood God. And if I was going to arrange his stage of truth, it might look something like this. At the front of his stage is going to be reason. It has to make sense, natural order. We see how things play out. This is the way it happens. And so in many ways, this guy's going to be like the philosopher. He's got his corduroy jeans on and, you know, sipping tea with his little finger up. And he's just thinking and pontificating about all of these rules. And he's got experience. I mean, that's pretty high up on his stage of truth. Scripture is definitely in there because he includes it. But it definitely seems like his reason, his experiences take precedence. And so logic for him rules, but his logic is flawed. I didn't get her permission this week, but in our life group, Jennifer Wadman gave a great example of the problem. She said, if you take these analogies and you say, it rained last night, therefore the ground is wet, that would be a true statement. But can you say, because the ground is wet, therefore it rained last night? Maybe. Maybe it was just a heavy dew that came, and that's why the ground is wet. Or a pipe underneath burst and has been leaking and seeping through the ground. So just because the logic flows one way doesn't necessarily mean that it has to flow the other way. And that's what Eliphaz did. He said, whenever you have sin, you're going to have pain and suffering and difficulty. Well, that's a true statement. Sin wrecks things. But can you then say, because you've got pain and difficulty, therefore you've sinned? Eliphaz holds to, yes, that is in fact the case. And what we're learning from Job is not necessarily. This week, we've got Bildad. And his stage of truth is a little bit different. At the very front, for him, is tradition. Is what have the great said from the past? Where have people landed on these issues? And he loves the past. He's very much into the justice of God. That's a very big deal to him. And he worships a God who he holds as being very powerful, but always just. And Bildad is going to be the theologian who comes along, and he's got all kinds of answers, but man, does he have a terrible bedside manner. He's the guy at your hospital, bed, he's bringing the sledgehammer. It's not exactly what you want to see and what you want to experience. Three times in this book he speaks, and the first one's in chapter 8. And he comes on the heels of Job having already responded to Eliphaz and some of the things that Eliphaz stated. And he's like, no, I'm struggling with this. And Job's point, if I was going to summarize the two chapters, it would be this. Fellas, you're not listening to what I'm saying. And on top of that, I don't feel like God is really listening to what I'm saying. I feel kind of alone out here. And so Bildad, when he hears this, he comes in angry. I mean, he's flying in hot on this. And to be very candid, this is a lot of times where a theologian with no heart will land. We're just going to hammer you with truth. You see how it begins here in chapter 8, verse 2. Bildad speaking, and he says, how long will you say these things and the words of your mouth be a mighty wind? Which translated from the Hebrew means, Job, you are full of hot air. In fact, this is the third time someone's talked about the other person and said, you got a whole lot of words, but you're not saying very much, my friend. I think this may be the first recorded instance of a group chat that we will experience and what happens, because words start flying and people take great offense. But here's Bildad's big idea and where he's going to go with Job. God is just. He has to find a way to explain suffering and yet uphold the justice of God. God is just. Now, is that a true statement? Everybody say, yeah. God is just. He is the essence of justice. He is always just. But here's where he goes. Therefore, if you're suffering, then you must have done something to deserve it. In other words, he's going in the exact same direction as Eliphaz. He says in chapter 8, verse 3, does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert what is right? So again, this is an argument based on principle. God can't be unjust. So Job, clearly, you are. You've done something wrong. And then comes what I'm going to suggest may be one of the absolute coldest verses ever stated in the Bible. Verse 4. If your sons sinned against him, then he delivered them into the power of their transgression. In other words, your kids died because they deserved it. Now you deal with it. Whoa. This is one of those cases where Bildad is being consistent with his doctrine. He's being consistent in what he believes, but you clearly don't say something like this, and not at a time like this. You got to find another way to deliver it, and you don't deliver it in a moment like this. And I kind of wonder if Bildad didn't maybe see something in Job that really knocked him back a step, because at this point, verse 7, he kind of gives him just somewhat of a crack of hope that things can get better. He says, though your beginning was insignificant, yet your end will increase greatly. What's implied here is, Job, you clean your act up, one day you'll laugh again. Just keep seeking God and do it as fast as you possibly can. And this is another instance where an individual is making an assumption that Job has done something wrong, so they're trying to coerce him into a false confession. They don't think it's a false confession, but Job knows it is, and God knows it is. Because remember what the challenge is? Satan says to God, the only reason people will worship you is because you give them good things. Take away the good things, they won't worship you. And for Job to then step into this and go, okay, I clearly did something wrong and make something up, he's falling prey to the exact same logic. God, you're not worthy of worship. What I really want is my life to be easier. Will you worship no matter what? You just sang about a few minutes ago, though he slay me, yet I'll serve it. Well, in verses 8 through 10, this is where he begins to appeal to some of the wisdom of the ancients. He says, please inquire of past generations. Consider the things searched out by their fathers. Will they not teach you and tell you and bring forth words from their minds? In other words, he's saying, this is what you got to lean on: tradition, authority. Trust the old dead guys, is the way I would put it. You know, go back to these fellows that have written from many years ago and hold to those things. And if the previous generations held on to it and it stood the test of time, then hey, it must be true, right? It belongs at the front of the stage of truth, in essence. Bring the time and the experience with the tradition. But as we'll see, tradition and others in the faith, while they do have a place on the stage of truth, they cannot be at the front. Now, he uses his reason based upon a couple of things. First, he kind of delves a little bit into creation. He compares the wicked to these marsh plants, and he says about marsh plants are very fast growing, and then not long after that, they're very short lived. And he's equating Job to that. And in verse 13, he connects the dots. So are the paths of all who forget God, and the hope of the godless will perish. So again, if you're in sin, you'll experience justice quickly, is his point. Now, is that true? If you're in sin, you will find a justice against that sin quickly. No, it's not true. There will be a day of justice in this life, maybe in the next, but at some point there is a reckoning. But does that mean that it happens now? No, it does not. So Bildad is looking at this guy whose hope is about to shrivel, and he tries to give him some sort of a hope in all this, and he says, well, he will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. So Bildad believes that there can be a means of restoration for Job, and that is a true statement, but he doesn't believe Job to be righteous in this case. He still thinks you clearly did something to get God's ire up and against you, and that's the error that he has here. And the reason he goes here is because of his doctrine. His doctrine will not allow him to see the reality of the situation. So while his doctrine is sometimes true in principle, it isn't an absolute. And he's inherited these dogmas, if you will, from others that often prove themselves true. But this is a guy who's clearly been locked away in his study for so long that he hasn't actually looked at the world as it actually is. Sometimes there'll be a delay in justice, and sometimes bad things will happen to good people. And all of this comes about through Bildad in his heartless counsel. And you find out he's much more attracted to his theories than to his friend, Job. Now, I love one of the statements Dr. James Dobson said years ago. He talked about parenting, and he made this comment. He said, I used to have 4 theories on child rearing and no kids. He says, and now I have 4 kids and no theories. And Bildad has got theories. He's got ideas about how things are going to be and where Job is, and he bases his entire theology on this divine retribution. And he's seen that practiced in the world, and that's, it has to be true. And that's why Job is going through his pain. But he's holding on to these things, and he hasn't gone through this kind of experience. He doesn't feel what Job feels. Well, Job continues to argue, and he kind of pushes back on Bildad. We won't necessarily go into that today. We'll look at it later. But in chapter 18, Bildad gets a second round at this guy. So he comes back around, and he's even more angry than he was before. And his counsel is going to be to Job in chapter 18. Hey, if you ignore our advice, there's going to be hell to pay. Literally, there is a hell. And he looks at the fate of the wicked all throughout chapter 18. And you see all these heavy words, words like darkness and traps and fire. Your name will be forgotten. And this, I mean, this is one of the first fire and brimstone preachers that you've got. And he loves talking about the justice of God and how that manifests itself in hell. And his point is, justice is coming, and Job, you're inching ever closer to it. And so the path you're on is dangerous. Friend, he's telling Job, this is just a small taste of what you're facing if you don't get things turned around. And so chapter 18, again, it's got a lot of theology about judgment and justice when you read it. Starting in verse 5, you start looking at the words that are used here. Their light goes out. Their flame is extinguished. Their stride is shortened. Their schemes come down. Verse 8, they are thrown into the net. Verse 9, a snare seizes them. Now, here's the issue. He's talking about all these things about the wicked, but for all intents and purposes, he's addressing an issue that doesn't really apply to Job at all. There's zero engagement with Job's actual situation. It's like going to a funeral and hearing the officiant preach on predestination. You know, I actually experienced that once. Went to a funeral, and expected to hear all about the guy and the gospel, and all I heard was the 5 points of predestination. And I remember thinking, okay, I can follow you on your points. I understand where you're going. Why are you preaching that here? Can we talk about the person whose body is in the casket? Can we talk about the family and find things that will minister to them? And it was a classic blunder made by a theologian who forgot to be a pastor. And that's what Bildad does. Chapter 18, he preaches a perfectly crafted seminary lecture, but it's in the wrong moment, to the wrong person, and it's definitely in the wrong tone. And Bildad's final appearance then, it comes at us in chapter 25. And this is going to be a very short chapter. It's a very weighty one. And he begins by worshiping about the greatness of God. He says, dominion and all belong to him who establishes peace in his heights. Is there any number to his troops, and upon whom does his light not rise? And we all read that and we go, yes, Bildad, you are right. God is majestic and God is holy. But then he goes into the punchline. I'm going to call it the gut punchline. Verse 5. If even the moon has no brightness and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man, that maggot, and the son of man, that worm. It's just kind of going back to Job again and sort of ripping away any hope that he has of approaching and being with God and letting him know, you want a day in court with God? He's too big, he's too high, and he's too holy for you. Just accept your suffering, Job, and you shut your pie hole and deal with it. And Bildad is a heartless theologian. He looks at God as a creator. God is the just. God is the omnipotent. But he's a God that is so high that he is unreachable and he is inaccessible to any of you. He won't have anything to do with you. And Bildad is the spiritual doctor growling at you because you gagged on the tongue depressor of his theories of religion. So again, much of what Bildad says, and when you look at it at face value, you're going to agree with. You're going to say, yeah, God is just. You're right on that, Bildad. The wicked will perish. You are correct about that. God is majestic. So what's the big deal? Why does God include him in this whole series of friends and among these counselors? Because I think there's two primary lessons we need to learn from this guy. He's got two fatal flaws. The first one is going to be a flaw of his manner. In some areas, he's got his doctrine correct, but he has no tact. He doesn't know how to express it. It's kind of like he's got an orthodoxy, but he doesn't have an orthopraxy that will be presented in a way that is in love. So he can speak truth, but without love. You ever been a part of a church that is all about truth? We're going to be about truth. We're going to truth, truth, truth. I'm not mocking truth. That is a very important part of being in the church. God is true, and we need to know what truth is. But you get truth by itself, it looks a whole lot more like law. And life can get real brittle, real hard. The God we worship, he's a God of truth, but he's also going to be a God of love. And this guy is going to build a theological system, but he does it in a way that he cannot listen to a suffering man. Love goes out the window. A lot of true points. And Job, we could look at a lot of them and go, that's all great. What's that got to do with the price of tea in China? You know, you're speaking of these things, but they don't have anything to do with me. And Job would hear all Bildad had to say, but then he could say this, you know, I believe in an all-powerful God. I know he's got all power and that he's just. Here's my question. Why does the all-powerful God not come to me? I believe that he shows his power, and I believe that he shows his majesty in nature. Why won't he show himself to me? That's where Job is struggling. So Job will agree with a lot of Bildad's true statements, but Bildad forgets how his audience will hear what he says and will interpret that because he presents it in a bad tone. I can't help but think that this is why, ladies and gentlemen, we find in the New Testament, in Romans 12:15, you rejoice with those who rejoice, but then what else do? We weep with those who weep. Bildad skips the weeping, and he jumps straight into the doctrinal statements. I'll speak for God. Now, I want to be clear when I say this. Whenever we're dealing with someone and they're hurting, that doesn't mean that we can't speak truth at all, that we just always have to keep our mouths shut, and you can't help if they have errant thinking, because sometimes that does happen when you're in suffering. But you got to be careful, and you got to be slow, and you got to be gentle. So we don't throw out the truth. True theology, it's a big deal. It's important. We should be learning it. We should be understanding more about God. And it's not meant to just be something that comes into our minds and then stay in the classroom. That doctrine is meant to go out and is meant to move us in our hearts in accordance with who God is and his truth. But quite frankly, often it's only the preacher that can listen and not just construct theological structures. It's a listening preacher or teacher that's going to obtain a ministry of help to other people. And often, it's that kind of a teacher or preacher that you hear. That's the kind of person who has been in pain. They get it. They understand. I was really marked by a story that I read in a book. Gosh, it's probably been 35 years ago. James Michener and The Source. Michener's book, what he did was he would take a historical event and he would bring a fictional story up next to it. So the account and the events usually lined up with history. It was just a fictional character that you would experience through it. And in The Source, it's all about Israel. And there's this one particular story, and there was a woman in the story, and she's married, she's happily married, she loves her husband very much. And there's another gentleman, I can't remember if it was the man's brother or just a man's friend, but I'll just call him his friend. The friend really wanted the man's wife, but he knew he couldn't get him because they were married. So what he did was he waited until this man went on a trip. And when the husband went off on a trip, he ambushed him and he killed him. Then he came back into the town knowing that the woman was alone and he raped her. And then he left. He was disgusted with her in the wake of having raped her. And the woman is utterly devastated, as you would imagine, just destroyed. And she locks herself up in her home for days on end, just in terrible angst, writhing, pain, recovering. I mean, it's just everything about it was brutal. And so she comes to this point and she goes, I know what I'll do. I'll go to the priest. And when I go to the priest, he'll help me. He'll tell me what I can do in light of the law, in light of God. He will give me that instruction. And so she goes to the priest. And he sits down with her, and she just tells everything that happened. And the priest says, I see, I see. And when did this happen? And she said, it was about 5 days ago. And he goes, I see. And he goes over, and he pulls out a scroll. And he puts the scroll on the table, and just kind of unrolls it. And he's going over the law. And as he's going over the law, there's a line in there that speaks about whenever a woman has been attacked, she's to cry out in the field or to let somebody know within 3 days. And he said, you said it's been 5 days. Yes, it has. The law says 3. You have violated the law. If this was a real event, you would have come to me sooner. You're lucky I don't take you out and have you stoned. And he kicked her out. That is Bildad. Concerned with what I know and with the rules and how is all this going to be presented. But at the end of the day, there is absolutely no heart. But there's a second flaw this man has. And this one is theological. And I want to thank the commentator Christopher Ashe, who has helped me a lot in these next few points. Because Bildad's bigger problem is not so much what he said. In many cases, it's what he didn't say. And so he says, good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad ones, that's it. But he's got no category for some other things that happen in this fallen world. He has no category for, I don't know, Satan. You know, because remember, we got the backstory, and we know that there's a spiritual battle going on, a spiritual challenge that's happening. And God gives Satan permission to come and to attack Job. Bildad has no account for that. That doesn't fit within his system. That there's some, it's all about natural law. If, then. And he's stuck with that. The other problem he has is he has no category for waiting. You know, the judgment is pretty much now. Now, does God allow for, I forget how you pronounce it, retributive justice? I think that's right. Does God allow for that? Yeah, and sometimes that does happen. Individual goes and robs a bank, has a shotgun, and they get killed in the process. Well, sometimes that kind of thing will happen in the moment. A bad thing happened to a person in the moment, but not always. And then on top of that, sometimes they're just not guilty, and you're waiting for this thing to happen, but it's not going to, because God isn't out to get them. Bildad's system also has no place for sacrifice. Because you think about it, what's the purpose of a sacrifice? A sacrifice is meant to give something up, its life, for the sake of another. It is someone who's going to be, or is an animal or a creature that will be innocent, that is spilling its blood for the guilty. And God says, I will reckon that to your account. This will be the covering for your sin. And he has no idea or concept of that. If you have done something, you got to pay. And that's his mentality. And his system has no place for redemption. Justice is hard for him. It is inflexible. So it's interesting when it comes to justice. Quite often we want justice for other people, don't we? Sure don't want it applied to me. But when somebody else is doing something to me, then I want it applied. Well, this is a guy who's like, I'm all about the justice because he's not the object of it. Or at least he doesn't feel like he's the object of it. And instead, he's just going to point other people to say, do what you can to earn God's favor. You know, get back on some sort of a ladder system, but earn some sort of favor. But redemption? No, it's not there for you. And his system has no place whatsoever for innocent suffering. And that, you know what that means? Bildad's theology has no place for the cross. No place at all. When Jesus, the innocent one, paid for the sins of the world. If Bildad were in Gethsemane in the garden, and he's watching Jesus pray, and he sees him sweating like, you know, drops of blood, and he'd probably say, Jesus, relax, relax. Because if you're innocent, like you say you are, then nothing's going to happen. Everything will work out. And then hours later, he would be standing at a cross looking up at Jesus, and I think he would say, it looks like you did do something wrong, Jesus. Let's quickly do a little post-mortem before you die, assess the situation, find out where you went wrong. But the cross reveals the ultimate flaw in Bildad's worldview. You see it in Isaiah 53, verse 5. He, Jesus, was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his wounds, we are healed. Jesus is the only one who was the truly righteous sufferer. And yet he suffered not for his own sins. He suffered because ours were given to him. They were placed on him. And so Bildad's theology here would never have been able to embrace the gospel, which demonstrates to us that Jesus, the innocent one, came to die for sinners, the guilty, to set them free from the wrath of God. And we have to come back and look when we see the sufferings of Job. They're just a preview at the end of the day of the price of grace required to unlock heaven for us. Because that's what Jesus would do, endure the suffering, but for no sin of his own. And at the cross, you find the justice of God and you find the compassion of God at the same place. A God who does not have to crush the guilty for their own guilt because he would willingly step in their stead to suffer that penalty and that price in their place. And so at the cross, justice is upheld and mercy can be applied. Amazing. Only an all-wise, all-knowing God could come up with something like that. And Bildad, he's got his PhD in theology. But man, did he get an F in empathy. And he got an F in the gospel. Because he looked too much on his tradition and taught solid truths, but misapplied them in a moment that required tenderness and not theory. Because Job didn't need a lecture. He didn't. He didn't need a chat GPT summary of all these doctrinal ideas. He needed a friend. That's what he needed. And sometimes the most spiritual thing that you can do with a hurting friend is maybe to sit in silence with them and mourn with them for a while they hurt. And let's be careful that we don't lock in so tight on truth that we forget to apply it and to speak it with grace. Jesus had both truth and grace. Ephesians 4:15, you speak the truth, but what? In a manner, in love. 1 Corinthians 13, Paul says, if I have all knowledge, but I don't have love, I am nothing. So we learn from Bildad in our responses in life. Let's think and believe more like Jesus when we encounter the suffering, because Jesus is the one who didn't merely offer answers, he offered himself. And unlike Bildad, he never showed up with a theological hammer. Instead, he showed up with nail-scarred hands.